If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Warning. This episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. At 3 a.m. on New Year's, 1980, an emergency dispatcher in St. Paul, Minnesota received a call. The voice on the other end is high-pitched, trembling, dissolving into sobs as he speaks. The caller says there's a girl, hurt badly, near the Malberg manufacturing plant off Pierce Butler Road. He does not give his name. When officers arrived, they found a 20-year-old college student, Karen Potek, lying in a snowbank. She was beaten so severely that her skull was fractured, her brain visible. But she was still alive. The anonymous caller who directed police to her body is the man who attacked her. Over the next 2 years, the same weeping, remorseful voice would call authorities again and again after every attack, after every murder, pleading for forgiveness, begging to be stopped, promising each time that he would turn himself in. He never did.
Please don't talk to me. I'm sorry, I killed myself. I said this for you guys.
This is A Study of Strange. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Michael May. Unlike other serial killers who contact the authorities or the press or just seek out publicity, those killers tend to do it to demonstrate a narcissistic superiority. The case today that we are talking about is different because the killer seems to be reaching out with remorse, asking for forgiveness. Though that is arguable because there are very intelligent profilers that debate why he was actually making these phone calls, and we will discuss that later in the episode. Of course, I am talking about the weepy-voiced killer whose name was Paul Michael Stephanie. Paul Michael Stephanie was born on September 8, 1944 in Austin, Minnesota, a small agricultural town on the southern part of the state. He was the second of 10 children, and his family was deeply Catholic. His parents divorced when he was young, and his mother remarried when Paul was 3 years old. His stepfather, by multiple accounts, was brutal. If the children ever got in the man's way, annoyed him in any fashion, he would become violent. At least one account I came across mentioned hitting a kid so hard that he fell down the stairs. 10 children, a small house with a violent man, and deeply religious. This is the circumstance of Stephanie's upbringing. After graduating high school, Stephanie made his way to Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities, in the mid-1960s. He drifted between jobs, shipping clerk, janitor, truck unloader at a steel mill. He married a woman named Beverly Leiter, had a daughter, but that relationship did not last. They divorced sometime in the 1970s, and he abandoned his daughter, though I will admit I couldn't find more details on the relationship with the daughter, so I don't know if it was quite abandonment or he just didn't communicate with her very often. But by 1977, Stephanie had been fired from his job as a janitor at the Malberg Manufacturing Company in St. Paul. He would say that he lost the job because he had a history of epilepsy, and he grew resentful and angry. He also had a girlfriend around this time, and she left him to move back home overseas for an arranged marriage. This was very upsetting to Paul Michael Stephanie, and here you have a handful of years where he's lost his family, he's lost his job, he's lost his girlfriend. Let's just say he was not in the best shape mentally. And just about 3 years after this firing, an anonymous call came from near that same machine shop that Stephanie had worked at. On December 31st, 1980, Karen Potak was 20 years old. She was a college student, and she had come to St. Paul to ring in the new year with her sisters. After midnight, she left the party that she was at, and she was walking alone near the Malberg plant when she encountered Paul Michael Stephanie. Soon after, the dispatcher received the anonymous call from what would be called the weepy-voiced killer. He directed emergency services to Karen's location, and because of that call, unique in serial killer history here, Karen Potak survived. Though she was left with lasting brain damage and carries no memory of the attack, she had been beaten within inches of her life. At the time, police logged the call, notated the hysterical high-pitched voice, and filed it away. They had no name, no suspect, no connection to anything that would help the case. Not yet. I want to take some time to talk about these phone calls because they are central to this story and defining the deeply strange elements in this case. There is no other case quite like it that I have come across in American criminal history. Serial killers rarely report their own crimes. They don't call 911 from payphones and confess or ask to be caught. They don't apologize. And the ones who do communicate with the police or the media, the Zodiac BTK killer, for examples, they do it for control, for power, for the thrill of taunting investigators. What Stephanie did was different. His calls feel like genuine distress. So he's not taunting police. He showed remorse. Remorse from a man who could not stop killing. Kimberly Compton was 18 years old. She had just graduated high school in Pepin, Wisconsin, a small town on the Mississippi River, and traveled to St. Paul, Minnesota on June 3rd, 1981. She was looking for a job for a fresh start for the rest of her life. It was her first day in the city. Three boys were playing near a freeway construction site that afternoon and found a young woman's body partially concealed in the brush. The medical examiner's report would show that she had been stabbed 61 times with an ice pick. The wounds were concentrated on her chest, stomach, and inner thighs. Sadly, there were a lack of additional clues for investigators to develop a suspect list. 48 hours later, though, a call came in. The same weeping, barely comprehensible voice, high-pitched and trembling. Police initially thought it might be a prank, but one detail stopped them cold. The caller mentioned an ice pick, and that detail had never been released to the media. Only the killer could have known it. They traced the call to a bus depot phone booth. They went to investigate that phone booth, but they couldn't find anybody, couldn't find videotape, security footage, anything like that that may help them identify this caller. Days later, they got another call. The same weeping, barely comprehensible voice, high-pitched, trembling, saying, "I don't know why I had to stab her. I'm so upset about it." After this call, the press now had a name, the weepy-voiced killer. For about a year, there didn't seem to be any activity from the weepy-voiced killer, and then a 32-year-old woman, Kathleen Greening, a school teacher, was found dead in a bathtub in her Roseville home, a suburb of St. Paul. Local authorities ruled it an accidental drowning, and the case was quickly closed. It would stay that way for 15 years. Spoiler alert, Stephanie murdered Kathleen Greening, but here is why people didn't connect the dots at first. Stephanie did not make a phone call for this one. The death looked on its surface just like a tragic accident. And because it didn't fit this profile of the weepy-voiced killer, there was no connection being drawn. But Kathleen Greening's address book, as they will find later, contained an entry, Paul S., and his phone number. This means Stephanie knew Kathleen Greening. We don't know why or how they knew each other, and we don't know what triggered him that day to drown her in her bathtub and walk away. The State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension eventually reclassified her death as a homicide. The truth would not emerge until 1997. On August 5th, 1982, Barbara Simons was 40 years old. She was a nurse in Minneapolis, and on this particular night, she walked into the Hexagon Bar. There, she met a charming, dark-haired man who asked her for a cigarette. She gave it to him. His name? Paul Michael Stephanie. As she left the bar with Stephanie later that night, she allegedly told a waitress, "He's cute. I hope he's nice since he's giving me a ride home." The next morning, a paperboy on his route spotted a woman's body along the banks of the Mississippi River. It was Barbara Simons. She had been stabbed multiple times. The wounds were circular, consistent with a Phillips screwdriver or an ice pick. 2 days later, the call came. That changed everything, because now police knew that they had a serial killer. They reached out to the FBI, and a criminal profiler offered an assessment. The caller was regressing during the calls, going into what she described as a juvenile state. Meanwhile, the bartender at the Hexagon Bar gave police a description of the man who left with Barbara Simons. Late 30s, 6 feet tall, dark hair, dark eyes. Investigators ran a photo lineup, and the bar staff were able to identify Paul Michael Stephanie. But police couldn't arrest him just yet. There wasn't quite enough evidence to do that. So they put him under surveillance. Denise Williams was 19 years old. She had been engaged in sex work for most of her teens. And on the night of August 21st, 1982, Paul Michael Stephanie approached Williams on Hennepin Avenue in Minneapolis. He offered her $100. She accepted, and they drove to his St. Paul apartment. He paid her $40 up front. And then he offered her a ride back into the city, and she accepted. He took back roads rather than the freeway, which might not seem like it's an unusual situation, but Williams started to feel like something wasn't right. Stephanie apparently began talking about his sexual fantasies, and he pulled over and stopped the car. He reached into the glove compartment and took out a screwdriver. He stabbed Denise Williams 13 times. One wound punctured her lung, another her liver, but Denise Williams fought back. She found a glass bottle in the car and she smashed it across Stephanie's face. In the chaos, she was able to get out of the vehicle screaming. A man who lived very nearby heard the screams, came running over, and physically tried to stop Stephanie from attacking Denise Williams again. She was able to get away, and then the gentleman himself, feeling like he was in danger, ran back to his house and called police. Stephanie fled. He drove home, but then he realized this gash on his head was very severe. He was covered in blood. And so Paul Michael Stephanie, suspected serial killer under active police surveillance, calls an ambulance, and authorities recognized his voice. That is how Stephanie was caught. The story goes that when one of the detectives working the case presented the Weepy Voice Killer case file to Stephanie and showed him photographs of the victims, apparently Stephanie's voice spontaneously shifted into that high-pitched, distinctive sounding voice from the phone calls, and authorities were again able to recognize the voice from the Weepy Voiced Killer. And so that was it. Everybody knew that he was the serial killer. He was charged with the murder of Barbara Simons and the attempted murder of Denise Williams. He pled not guilty. The trial was in 1985, and at the time, voice analysis technology was not as sophisticated as it is today, so they couldn't use that to definitively link him to the recordings. But his ex-wife, his sister, and a woman who had lived with him, they all testified that they believed the Weepy Voice Killer on the recordings was Paul Michael Stephanie. Additionally, the prosecution had eyewitness testimony. The bartender, as an example, who saw Simons leave with Stephanie that night. And Denise Williams, of course, identifying her attacker. Paul Michael Stephanie was convicted of second-degree murder in the death of Barbara Simons and the attempted second-degree murder in the attack on Denise Williams. He was sentenced to 40 years for murder, 18 years for the attempted murder, a combined sentence of 58 years. Investigators knew, or strongly believed, that he was also responsible for the murder of Kimberly Compton and the beating of Karen Potak, but they didn't have enough evidence compiled that they thought they could use in trial for those murders. So Stephanie went to Oak Park Heights Maximum Security Prison. He never admitted to the Weepy Voice Killer calls. He never acknowledged the other attacks. He denied everything. That is, until December 1977. Stephanie had been diagnosed with melanoma, skin cancer that had already spread throughout his body. He had less than a year to live, and he had one request. He wanted a photograph of his mother's headstone. But in exchange for that photograph, he agreed to talk. He confessed to the attack on Karen Potak. He confessed to murdering Kimberly Compton. He confessed to the murder of Barbara Simons. He confessed to the drowning of a woman in a bathtub, but he could not remember her name. So police worked backwards. They went to the county medical examiner's office and began researching every freshwater drowning in the relevant time frame. And after days of searching, they found the case. Kathleen Greening, the 33-year-old school teacher found in her bathtub in 1982, officially ruled an accidental drowning. Stephanie, though, knew details about the apartment, about the death scene, that only the killer could have known. And again, they also found his phone number in her address book. He also mentioned that there had been one more murder, a woman he had drowned in a bathtub somewhere else, and that it's a woman that he could not identify. Investigators researched that case, but they have never been able to confirm a match for this fifth possible victim. So there is reason to believe that there is another victim of the Weepy Voiced Killer that has not been identified. Paul Michael Stephanie died on June 12, 1998 in the infirmary of Oak Park Heights Maximum Security Prison. He was 53 years old. So I want to come back to the one question, the thing that makes this a very unique case. Why did he make those phone calls? One of the FBI profilers who worked the case, Special Agent Larry Brubaker, explained that this had to do with Stephanie's religious upbringing, Catholicism, where the act of confessing your sins, even anonymously, even to a 911 dispatcher rather than a priest, may have functioned for Stephanie as a release, a confession, to be absolved for the evil things that he did. Stephanie himself, near the end of his life, confirmed some of this. He told investigators that he heard a voice in his head that said, "Paul, it's time to kill." And after the murders, he said he would go to a Catholic church and sit in the back and cry. His mother, he said, had always told him, "If something hurts you, go to God." Another FBI profiler offered a different point of view on this, saying that the calls represented a cat and mouse dynamic, a way of asserting simultaneous guilt and power. The caller is telling you, "I did this," but it's also kind of saying, "You can't catch me unless I turn myself in." So he's both confessing and taunting. What's striking to me when reading through all of these accounts is how completely compartmentalized his violence appears to have been. He functioned in daily life. He went to work. He lived his life normally. And then it's like a switch would go off and he would kill. He talked about it a little bit where he would say he'd be with a woman and have no intention of doing anything violent. And then just very suddenly he would have to kill her. And detectives have theorized that something possibly triggered him. And one of the theories that's been floating around is that all of his victims were wearing red. So something about a woman in the color red would set him off. There's also a criminological term that's been used, the dissociative state. Whatever is behind this bizarre behavior, I want to highlight the two women that survived his attacks, Karen Potack and also Denise Williams, who was able to find that glass bottle and instinctively and quickly save herself by attacking Paul Michael Stephanie. And she is, in every meaningful sense, the reason Stephanie was caught. When you cover terrible people in these true crime stories, it feels really good when there's one or two badass people that fight back.
You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.